The following interview was submitted to the Texas A&I Oral History and Folklore Collection in partial fulfillment of a Texas history course under Dr. George Colson in the fall of 1973. Royal Milton Bayless is 80 years old, and within the span of these 80 years, he has led a life throughout the world, having lived in Europe as well as Africa and various parts of Canada as well as our own nation. He is also one of Kingsville's first citizens, arriving in this city in 1907 on one of the numerous homeseeker trains that were bringing new settlers to South Texas. This is his story.
Yeah. I can tell you a little bit about the very early years here. For instance, I captained Kingsville's second high school football team. I helped organize football here, played in the first year, and then captained the second year. I never did finish high school. My father died, and I had to quit school and go to work.
How old were you when you got here?
When I what?
How old were you when you came to Kingsville?
I was about 12, between 12 and 13, maybe mm-hmm. I'd be 13 already. Mm-hmm.
And where did you come from?
Well, we came down here from South Dakota, Lead City, South Dakota, where we'd been just for the year. That's where I was born. But the year before that, we spent in England, and before that, for the first 12 years of my life, were mostly in South Africa. My father was a miner, and when the gold was found around Johannesburg, you remember, not too long after the diamond fields were found down there at Kimberley, that they found those wet waters around the fields, you know. That's a streak there of about 40, 50 miles, just solid reef of gold, you know. Still mining it. Still more gold, I think, coming from South Africa than any other one place. Mm-hmm. But my father was born in a little village in England, Duffield in Derbyshire. And his father came over here to the States when they found gold, you remember, in the Black Hills?
Yeah.
Just before Custer's deal, you know. In 66, they'd made a treaty with the Sioux, you remember?
Mm-hmm.
That they would not allow the white men to go into the Black Hills. It was their happy hunting ground, you know, and sacred to their religion, too. But some prospectors slipped in there and found gold in there in about 71 or 2 along in there. And, of course, when that happened, why, the people flooded in there. That's what brought on the war in which Custer was killed. And anyway, people from all over the world came to the strike there, just like they did to the California gold field rush, you know, and later on in Montana and up and through there, or about the same time as the Black Hills. And that Hearst Homestake Mine at Lead City is still the biggest gold mine in North America. Still brings them in a pretty nice profit. But anyway, my father's father, be my grandfather, heard about the gold strike, and he had been in the British Army for a long time. I don't know how long my father died while I was young and wasn't smart enough to learn too much about my people, you know, and he was gone a lot of the time. We left South Africa about 1904, came over to England, spent a year there, then came on over and spent a year in the Black Hills, and then my mother came down here looking for a warm climate like the South African climate, because he felt like he didn't want to go back to the snow, you know, after being gone for so long. But anyway, his people, I'll jump around too much, his people came over here because his father came to that gold rush in the Black Hills. And I think they probably got here in the, I don't know for sure, see, that's the trouble, but about 79, 80 along in there. Let's see, let me think. Maybe a little later than that. Somewhere between 80 and 85, we say. And, of course, my father went into mining up there then, in the Black Hills. Well, just like his father before him, when he heard about this big gold strike in South Africa, he went there. Well, I was born before he left. And after he left, the brother next to me was born. And then my mother took us and went over to South Africa. And she, we'd never been east of the Mississippi before, as far as, yeah, no, I said she was born in Avoca, Iowa. But then and she'd never been too far east.
So that was
and she got homesick and wanted to come back to the States. Well, she came back and she was pregnant then, and my first sister was born, see. My mother had 10 children altogether. We lost three of them. Two of them we lost in the smallpox epidemic just before the Boer War broke out in South Africa. They had a terrible smallpox epidemic. My father came down with it first. See, he was what you'd call a kind of a contractor most of the time. For a while, at different times, he was mine captain in some of the mines and be kind of a foreman under the manager, you know. But most of the time, he was in the contracting business because there was more money in it. There'd be two of them would be partners. One would work day shift for a month while the other worked night shift and then change around, see. And each one would have his gang of about 30 to 40 men. And they bought their own candles and supplies, powder and all that kind of stuff, dynamite, fuses and all that. And they deepened shafts and lengthened tunnels and all that kind of thing. See, those were deep mines. That was almost a granite ore, a granite with a lot of, I can't think. So that's one of the thing about getting old. You begin to grope for words. A lot of crystal-looking stuff in it, white, you know. Hard as it could be, the mining was a very expensive process. That stuff was brought up and it was crushed by stamps. In fact, all the years that I was on the round there as a boy, you never got away from that noise, all the, you know, continual roar all over the place, something like that thing makes up. There's wind tunnels. And they crushed that ore with stamps, and then it was run over amalgam tables, and then after that, the residue was put in cyanide tanks, and that extracted the last of it. Then that stuff was thrown out. It was kind of a white sand, and they were when I was a boy there in South Africa, around all those mines were great big hills of that white sand, you know, the residue. And when the wind blew, it blew that blooming stuff all over, you know. Now, Johannesburg is a pretty big city, but even in my time, it had streetcars. That is, before the turn of the century and after. They had streetcars and pretty good town already, see. And but anyway, my mother came over here and was over here about 6 months, I suppose, until this sister was born. Then we went back and we were there then until we came away the last time. And my father stayed there. We came to England and living was very reasonable and cheap there, you know, and she figured she could save more money. And then over here to the States to prepare, find a place to move to, and she that's where she learned about this country. This railroad had just been finished in 1904, as you probably know since you're studying this history, and there was a fellow here they had by the name of Doherty, D-O-H-E-R-T-Y, not D-O-U-G-H, and he, I don't remember what his title was, but he put out a magazine called Gulf Coast magazine, and there may be copies of it down here in the library. They should have some if they could find them anywhere. And it was a slick paper magazine that telling all about what a wonderful country this was, you know. And it, in fact, it. And then the railroad put on these homeseeker trains. Well, my mother came down in 1906 on one of them, and she bought an 80 out here. And then the next spring, 1907, we moved down here. Well, just before we left, she got a letter from my father, and then we didn't hear from him for a whole year, and we wondered, couldn't imagine what had happened. Finally, through some friends of ours that had left Africa just before we did, and went to the Black Hills, and then had followed that new gold rush out there at Tonopah and Goldfield about it, you know, in 1904.
Yeah.
Remember that rush? They were out there, and they were in touch with people in South Africa, and somebody had told them that my father had been badly hurt in a in a action explosion. And it turned out that that's what had happened.
Was he still alive?
He was alive, but he was in the hospitals. It was a year before, from the time it happened, before he got home, see?
Mm-hmm.
After he got into the hospital, he lost an arm, an eye, and his teeth. Pretty badly bunged up. And we burned badly around the lower part of the body. And in the hospital, a nurse forgot the hot water bottles and burned him from his ankles up to his waist. They had to graft skin on him. So all in all, he was a long time, see, and in such bad shape he couldn't write. And most of them, our friends had either left there already when we had, or most of the men were dead already and buried, because the trouble down in that country was these mines were very wet, and take a man like my father, he'd go down with his gang, and they'd drill about all the holes they could in 8 hours or 10 hours, how long they worked, I don't remember now, and they'd set their fuses and everything and light them and then signal Cage to take them up, see? Well, the next shift would come down maybe 2 or 3, 4 hours later, but there'd still be that dust in the air.
Yeah.
And they'd breathe that dust and it caused miner's phthisis, you know, miner's consumption, whatever you want to call it. And in time, I can remember that before we left there, that nearly all of, for instance, this family I was telling you about, which is such close friends of ours, their husband and father, the Irish people named Stackpool, he was dead and buried over there before they left. And so then when he died, well, they came on over ahead of us. And they were very close friends of ours. So that's why the minute they heard about the dope over there in the gold field, well, they wrote my mother. And that's the first we knew what had happened. But anyway, my father came back, and of course they told you that you could come down here and clear land and grow fruit or vegetables and that, and make enough to pay for your land. You know how these real estate men are about their stuff. Turned out, now, 1 year while my father was here, after he got back, we grew a couple of carloads of the most beautiful Bermuda onion you ever saw, flat white ones, just as sweet as an apple. And shipped 2 carloads of them and got it done back for freight on them. Things like that took our capital pretty quick and broke my father's heart. He goes back to Africa, even though he had crippled like he was, because the only thing he really knew outside of it was mining, of course. Well, he hit Johannesburg. And the first big miners' strike was on that had ever happened out there. And he wouldn't have anything to do with working there under those conditions. So he took a contract to go up to the Gold Coast, Kumasi, and worked there a couple of years. And then he finally wrote, like I say, he wrote and told my mother to tell Milton he'd better find a job because he didn't think he'd live over another 3 months. Well, he did live that 3 months and got home and lived 3 more months, but he died about 6 months from the time he'd written that letter. I think that if it hadn't been for that accident, you know, that hurt his constitution so much, and being away from my mother where she could have taken care of him properly, is probably what helped him get it, because he didn't seem to have that trouble, no cough or anything, when we left South Africa. But here's what happened over there. While I was there, as a kid, most of the labor had been colored, Negro labor. They send these labor contractors out all over to these different Zulu and Bantu clans, and their chiefs would force these people to come down and work. They'd give them some kind of present, and a lot of trinkets and all that kind of junk, you know. A lot of those had hardly ever seen a white man until the Boers moved up into that country, and even then, out away from the towns, all that, where they were getting these laborers, say up north in what is Rhodesia now, and over in Buchanan Islands, those Negroes had didn't know what a white man looked like. And their chiefs would send them down there on a 3-year contract, and a lot of them would die right before that 3 years was up, because they were people that had lived up, you know, out in the country, in the sunshine and that kind of thing. And they'd come up out of these mines, those cages had come up. Your white miners would all be dressed in oil skins and everything like that, see. And these fellows a lot of the time didn't have anything on but a breech clout. And so, breathing that dust and being in that damp and that, well, a lot of them, it'd last no time at all. And the rest of them would go back to where they come from, and lots of them would die there. So it became known among all those villagers and that it was dangerous, you know, to go down there. And so it got to where they couldn't get these Negroes to come down there. So the British government goes over there and makes a contract with the Empress Dowager of China. This was back in 1900, right after the Boer winter, about 1902 or 3. And they brought 1 million Chinks over there to work, see? Some of them came in there before I left. I was on two last mines my father was on, while we had Chinese. And so I got to see that. But just like capital has. Now, I've always been a liberal, politically, see. At the present time, I'm a Republican, but for one reason only, and that's security. This business of wanting to cut $30 billion off our defense fund and all that, with Russia building up all her forces like she is, I can't see it. Couldn't see it. And so the last election, I backed Nixon, and you may have seen some of my letters in the paper. Have you ever? No. I write this caucus paper once in a while, and I may have a letter in this Wednesday's Kingsville paper if they publish it. If not, it'll be in some, because they told me they were going to publish it. Mm-hmm. It's on the Salindi deal in Chile. But anyway, I know that, of course, one people just the same as any other, that they'll all make use of anyone they can. Right here in our country, we've had all kinds of working men. Our coal miners, for instance, have been fighting, trying to get decent preventive measures in their mines, you know, and all that sort of thing. And they don't get very far, and they're talking about now that they know that there's going to be such a demand for coal, and this transforming of plants into coal burning outfits instead of, they're talking about a strike already. You've seen that maybe in the paper. So you can't blame them in a way. Capital is always in the past. Of course, our capital, American capital, is becoming more enlightened all the time and meeting you halfway, but they've been forced. Organized labor is the one that forced them to do it. You start reading your British history, for instance, go back to the 1800 and see the conditions that the people there in England were working under in those days, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, you know. They had kids there in those mines in Wales working 12, 16 hours a day when they were 6, 7, 8 years old, crawling in tunnels just big enough for them to go through, pulling a little coca pound of coal, all that kind of thing. Women nothing was done to take care of their health, their wages were pitiful, and all that kind of thing. So I'm quite a history fan, even though I didn't get to go to school as much as I wanted to. I was headed, my father was a man who realized the value of an education, and he had us all pointed to go to school, but when what happened to him killed it all, see. So I had to leave high school, and I was captain of the football team the year I quit high school. I mean, I quit before this. I played with a gang.
Yeah.
The first Mr. Plato here, that is Plato number 2, they called him, Charlie Plato the 2nd, Playworks brought him in here and set him up in the Kingsville Hardware and Lumber Company. And He was a swell guy, by the way, fine fellow. And he put me to work out of high school. And they permitted me to go down and play with the team, practice with them, and go on the games. Yeah. Of course, you can't do that now, but in those days, they didn't have the rules they have so much. I wasn't a big man, but I was always very fast, very fast.
What did you
do? I loved the game, too.
What did you do between the time that you mentioned when you first got here, you were 12 years old, and your father had been back, and he died? Did he die here?
Yeah, he got back here three months before he died.
Okay.
He's buried out here, one of the first men buried in that cemetery out there, way back in the brush now. You know what where that is? San Fordyce? It's the next place the other side of Mission. No, there's no station or anything there, but at that time it was the end of the road, and there was a lot of gravel pits there. And I watched engines there and at Mission, then finally at Brownsville and all over the road at different times. I worked for about a couple of years for him, and I got a promise from my superintendent of motor power, a man by the name of Hoffman, or a swell guy. But here's what happened. I was only 18 years old, and when I applied for the job, I put the correct age down on my application, see? And at that time, that they promoted the watchman to fireman when they needed a fireman. Well, first thing you know, after I'd been at work about a year, the man ahead of me had been promoted, and then they promoted the man behind me, fire. So I was working at either Mission or Brown's at the time, I've forgotten for sure. I got them to send me a man to read. I came in and I went into Hoffman's office, and he looked up and wanted to know what I wanted, and I told him. I said, "Mr. Hoffman, you've put so-and-so out as a fireman, and I'm older than he is. In seniority, I meant, of course. And why? Because they had already told me that I'd done a pretty good job for them. Two or three times there in an emergency that I can tell you about later, that I did them a pretty good turn." He said, "Well, I don't know, Milt. Just a minute." And he reached up, pigeonhole, and pulled down a paper, and it was my application. He says, "You're only 18 years old." And he said, "The law in this state, you've got to be 21 to fire." Well, I didn't know that, see. And he was the kind of man you wouldn't ask to allow, being the oldest of a family of seven kids at that time, see, my three sisters had died. I needed a job that paid better than the engine watching job. In fact, that's the reason railroading at that time was one of the best jobs for a untrained man that you could get. And so I happened to think then, and I said, I knew there were some guys working on these yard jobs, and they were not 21 and were not known. Some boys that had gone to school with me, for instance, one's over here, another man you might talk to that could tell you a lot, probably more than I could, is Leland Marsters. He and Foy both, both railroad men, and both put their whole lives in right here on this railroad. And Leland went to work for him before I did the first time, and Foy was working for him when I came back here. And Foy, I coached Foy on a football team in 1516, just before the First World War. I was working as a bookkeeper and manager down here at Dr. Allison's pharmacy. Well, anyway, I asked him, I said, "How about letting me have the next switch engine job then? See, that law didn't cover that. You didn't get out on the main line, it was all right. You didn't have to be 21 years old." So he said, okay, he'd give me the next switch engine, see? Well, I went back to work, and maybe two or three months later, I got a call to come into Kingsville that Mr. Hoffman wanted to see me, and I wondered what I'd done, you know. Come on in, and went into his office, and this is the kind of man he was. He said, "Bayless," he said, "I want you to meet your new master mechanic." And it was this man, Nolan. Jerry Nolan, an Irishman from up, and I think he came from Minnesota or somewhere up in there, Nebraska, someplace. And he turned to this man Nolan and he said, "Mr. Nolan, I promised this man the next switch engine firing job. Will you see that he gets it?" And he promised he would, see. So I went on back to work, and I got moved around, and I happened to be on a job up here at Sinton. I got word my mother was very ill. I phoned into the, no, I didn't phone. I sent we had a radio telegram service in those days, and I sent a wire into the general foreman here, told him I'd gotten word that my mother was very ill, pleased to send me relief. I got a wire right back that he had nobody to relieve me. Well, there'd been a young fellow climbing on my engine in the evening when it came in, and he had fired for the San Antonio and Ramsey's Pass that runs through Sinton. I don't know why he lost the job. I don't remember whether he ever told me or not, but he sat on my engine talking to me when I'd be getting it ready, filling it up, you know, and all that kind of thing, and working injector for me on that side. So I knew he knew how to handle the job all right. And he'd asked me if I thought he could get a job in Kingsville. Well, I didn't know, of course, see. But when this happened, I sent a wire back to this foreman and told him that there was a man here that had been working for the SAP and was wanting to come to Kingsville to work, knew how to watch an engine. How about putting him on the engine? But I had to come in, see. I got word back that I could. So I left this guy on the job and come on into Kingsville. And when my mother had gotten over the worst part of her sickness, down by the name of Hamilton, he was watching engines down there, and I was in Brownsville when he got his job. And he was he said he was 17 years old, but he was about 15, I think. And he'd run away from home in Houston. They put him to work there. And when I left, he was working as a watchman, see. And they had a home seeker engine tied up at San Benito. And he was set up there to watch it. He went to sleep and let it blow up on him. And lucky for him, when the water got down, was set up there to watch it. He went to sleep and let it blow up on him. And lucky for him, when the water got down to where there was no more, the steam pressure had dropped way down. So when it blew out the washroom, it blew back out of the fire door and up the explosion, the puff of air that he was sleeping in the side seat blew him out of the window. It didn't hurt him any, but he'd ruined the engine, see. And that's where they were sending me. I didn't know it then, but that's what they want me down there for. They had to have a man down there quickly, because it there's where they tied up most of their home seeker engines. They were running lots of them in those days, see. That all that valley, when I first went down the Wyoming, was nothing but a mesquite wilderness, see. And you know what it's like now. You do know the valley, don't you?
I'm from Brownsville.
What it's like. Yeah. So you see, it took a lot of home seeker trains to bring those people down that came into this country. And so we lots of times have, I worked there, there's just two watchmen and a hostler, besides the mechanics that we had to work, and we'd have to handle sometimes as many as 12 or 15 engines a night. Keep the fires in them, you know, and see that they didn't water and all that kind of thing, and it was quite a job for two men. But anyway, this is where you want me to go, see? And I went on to get my call and come back, and here he was standing kind of downcast, and he said, Bayless, he said, boss says he's not going to have you watch an engine. You better go over and talk to him. I don't know what's the matter. So I went over to this guy, Mass Mechanics Office, Nolan, see? He went in, And he looked up, and I said, you want to see me, Mr. Dalton? He said, yes, he said, didn't I send you to Sutton to watch engine? Of course, he hadn't done it personally, but as the boss, I said, yes, sir. And he said, who gave you permission to leave there? And then before I could say anything, well, he started in. He said, by God, he says, you hired a man and put him to work up there. He says, I'm the only man that can hire and fire men in this department. He went on, you know. He said, I'm not letting you go out to watch engine now. You go to work here in the yard. And so he kept me, this is hot summer was coming on, he kept me here looking after these, what they call, they had engines, the dull season coming on, see. It was the cool season here, which was when the vegetables and fruit and all that were moving so much. And I worked there, and they give me every damn dirty job they could find, except picking up trash, see. They had a Negro doing that with a, he'd have a long stick with a nail on the end of it, you know, and picked up the paper, and then I thought if they ever told me to do that, I'll quit, much as I needed a job. But I put up with a lot of that kind of thing, but finally, there's a guy went up here with a freight train and leaving Refugio. Do you know the railroad? A little bit out of Refugio, you make a bend around over a creek. Well, this guy put about 15 cars into the ditch there, see? And they had to send up a wrecker, and of course they had to have an engine and to take care of the pull the wrecker and do the work around there, and they had to have a man to watch the engine, and they didn't have another man, they had to send me. So I go up there, and we were there about a week or two, had all the cars picked up, put back on the track and everything, and finally got ready to, they sent a machinist up to take down the side rods and block the valve motion on the wrecked engine, and we got word to bring all that stuff and come back to Kingsville, and I got word to messenger this wrecked engine in. Well, messenger jobs belong to the firemen, and they paid firemen's wages. And whenever a watchman, as a rule, got that job, he just put in a application for fireman's pay for it and did it. And I did, Lord no. There's a guy here by the name of Rowe, who was the general foreman at that time, and he didn't like me. I was pretty independent, always had been, although I always did a good job. And he came in, I was in the machine shop where a whole bunch of the, I mean, you know, all the guys in there knew me. Some of them, I taught a lot of them how to swim and played football for others and all that kind of thing. And he threw a chit down and says, the boss says you don't get it. I was at, I think I was at the place where you thread bolts and nuts and that kind of thing, or I could have been, I used to have to take these hose. You know, they'd blow out between the air hose every so often, and they'd have to put new hose on. Well, I'd take the clamps off them if they were in good shape, and they'd use them on the new hose. Things like that. Any job they could find, you know, they needed someone. And that's what I was doing. I was either there or at the drill press or something, and he coming through that down and said, you don't... Oh, when it was first given to me, I just got it through the regular channel. And the firemen had heard about it, and they said, give it to us, Bayless, and we'll collect it. I did. And then this come through this down to me, and the note from Nolan was to the effect that the contract called for him to pay fireman's pay when they messaged engine, but not for engine watchman. So I didn't get it. Well, that finished me, see. Just 2 days before, we had a machinist here by the name of George Jensen. He was one of the Scandinavian settlement, come from out there. That was the first settlement out in this country, you know, Scandinavians out here, and that's where we bought our land out among them. And he was one of the best mechanics they had. He was a good machinist, and he was also an electrician. And at that time, we had a lot of these motor cars that run with a gas engine, you know, and they'd have the engine department, then a baggage and mail department, then a passenger. You've seen them.
Yeah.
They run for long years between Brownsville and Mission. And it would tie up in Mission. It would start out there and go to Brownsville and back, and then we had a passenger train that tied up at Brownsville and run the mission and tied up at Brownsville. That made the round trip. So that you had the motor car going one way and the train the other. That was your original passenger service down there. Well, anyway, they had one of these that had to have its armature rewound, and they popped it on a track that was right in front of the mass mechanics office and the storeroom and all that stuff down in the old days. Of course, it's all been changed and gone now, you can't tell, but so I had been given the job of helping him while he's on this job. As a helper, you know, I'd help machinists sometime, boiler maybe, anybody that needed. So we were there working on this, watch him, and old man come out, the master mechanic, Nolan, stood there watching us, see? And he had a habit of standing, he's as short as I am, maybe even shorter, standing like this, you know, watching. And while he's standing there, here come a big raw bone engineer up by the name of Broker, Louis Broker. He's dead now, he died about 2 years ago. And he's a big fellow, about 6 feet, 6 feet one or two, something like that. And he'd been promoted just that year, you know, the season before. And coming up from the valley, he had some kind of engine trouble and lost an engine. They had to go haul him in. So rather than face the old man right off the reel, he laid off for a week. When he got ready to go to work, he came in and marked up. Wasn't going to see the boss at all, see? Told him, nope, you can't go to work until you talk to Mr. Nolan. Mr. Nolan wants to see you. And that was him. He came up, see, and Nolan let into him, and he called him everything you could call a white man. And I'd never seen a man take that from another one before, see, and I just, my blood boiled. I didn't like the little bastard anyway, myself, and to hear him talk to a man like that and get away with it, it just burned me up, see. So when this guy come in that couple of days later and threw that down, said, no, you don't get it. I threw my tools down, and I said, well, I'm going and tell that guy what I think about him. And, of course, roll, he'd start off, you know, but as soon as he'd gone, all these guys, go on in there, Bayless, and tell him. So we were gone. To get back, I went to work for Plato, and I took a job. After the first year with Plato, he came to me, and the superintendent of school here was named Colson, and I was further, as well as captain of school, the football team, was one of the honor students. And so they asked me if I would like to take the janitor's job down at this new high school that had just been built and finish my high school, see? And of course, that's what I wanted. So I went to work down there and played football with the kids and all that kind of thing. Well, Mr. Colson had a couple of boys, and the oldest one, Tom Colson, was a big, awkward sort of kid, but he was on the first team, I mean, pretty heavy, and he was unnecessarily rough in the practice. To make a second team get enough of them to play, we had to use pretty small kids, you know. Wasn't a big school in those days. Kingsville was just a small town. And I remonstrated with him two or three times about being too rough in his tackling and that of kids. He just laughed at me, so I gave him a little bit of what he was giving the kids, although he was a bigger man than I was. And I think he must have gone to his father and complained, because first thing you know, Colson came to me one day, and this hurt me more than losing out was the fact I'd always thought Colson was a wonderful man. But he told me, he said, Bayless, he said, you can't do your work and go to school here very well. You'll have to give up the schooling. See, so I don't remember just how he put it to me, but anyway, I was not to go to class anymore. So, and here's the funny thing. There was some kind of a split in the school board. We had a man here by the name of Rogers. It was president of the school board then at that time, I think. And he came to me at getting toward the end of the year, and he said, Milton, he said, Mr. Colson doesn't want you down there as janitor this next year, but if you want the job, it's yours. And I told him, no, I wouldn't have it. I said, the only reason I took it was because I wanted to finish high school, and I said, since since Mr. Colson has told me I can't do that, I'm not interested at all. So that's when I took my first railroad job. I went down here and learned to watch engines and went to the valley. I watched my first engines at Sam Fordyce out there. It was the end of the line at that time. I went over and went into his room, and he looked up, and I said, Mr. Nolan, I said, I've quit. You can't fire me. And I said, now I'm going to tell you what kind of a man you are. And I said, by God, you talk to me like you did that guy yesterday, or whatever day it was, and I'll clean up the floor with you. Boy, he started to grin. Oh, Bayless, he says, come on and go back to work and work for promotion. I said, hell, I'd work for you 1,000 years, and you wouldn't promote me. You give me all the dirtiest jobs you could around here trying to get me to quit. And I said, well, I'm quit. I'm through now. So he had a chief clerk, one of the guys that I'd played football with, and one of three brothers that were here. One of the oldest one was head of the of this milk deal out here when it belonged to the King Ranch when they were running it for Hygieia took it over for years until he retired. Now this was the brother next to him, and playing football, he was a bigger man than I was, and just as old at that time. I don't know why, but he didn't like me because I roughed him around too much playing football, I guess. I really played for keeps. I wasn't dirty, but I was rough. I wasn't afraid of, you know, you've seen guys playing football afraid of physical contact. You can't play football and be that way. But anyway, he was chief clerk there, see? He'd gone on while I was working as an engine watching one thing and gone to school, finished college and one thing or another. And whenever I was working for one of these mechanics, say a machinist or anything, maybe had to have some kind of equipment or tools or supplies to go, you'd have to go in with a requisition to get it, see? And he'd always acted, I had to get my requisition from him like maybe I was trying to steal something from him. And I never let on. But when this happened and I saw I couldn't get I was mad clear down on my toes. He couldn't get anything out of the old man. His office was, the next office held the force for the whole thing. So I went through the door, and the chief clerk sits here like this, facing the hall works, and then all the others were facing him, see? And right across the aisle from him was the mechanical timekeeper at that time. Later on, he came up here and was the main timekeeper up here at the main office. His name was H.N. Scott. And he was sitting right across from him. He was a big, raw-boned bird. And the reason I'm telling you all this, this guy was sitting with his back to me, and of course I walked over and I got him on the cold, and he looked up, you know. I said, listen, every time I came in here with a requisition, I said, you've been snotty as hell. I said, now, by God, just say boo, and I'll slap the hell out of you. And at that time, there was about 20 clerks in that place, and some of them were women. And I think he had that snotty attitude toward all of them, and they didn't like him, see? And it just tickled the hell out of him. I could tell that right away. But he just sit there. He wouldn't move, and he wouldn't even answer me, see? And I stood there a minute or two and waiting for him to get up. I was going to knock him down, sure as hell, but he wouldn't move. So I walked on out, see? Years later, I came back here and went to work for the company. I went to work for the San Martin Rio Grande Valley down there first, see? My father-in-law was aged out at Rio Hondo, and I was on my way to Florida. My wife was down here visiting with the two kids we had, and I got down here. I'd sold out in Seattle and worked for the city up there and drove down here and go to pick her up and go, and she wouldn't go. She said, I'm not going to Florida. That if you aren't going back to Seattle, Papa says they're hiring firemen here. Why don't you go to work here? You used to railroad, so that's all you railroad against me. But eventually, I worked there 2 years for them before that we were finally taken in with this one. Actually, the main line owned the whole setup, you know, from the start. But on account of the law and that kind of thing, they were run as an independent outfit for a while. But anyway, I had some reason to go in about my time here for the first time, and I went in, and here was H.N. Scott, who was the timekeeper, see? First time I'd seen him in years. In fact, since that day that he heard me tell this guy that he looked up and saw me, and on he started grinning. I knew goddamn well just what he was thinking about. So anyway, to make a long story short, I worked around odd jobs. Went to Seattle 1 year, 1914, the year the war broke out in Europe, trying to find, I had some people up there and thought I could go to work up there. And since these people were all on my mother's side, which finally did take us to Seattle a few years later, they had thought I could get on up there. But just about the time I went there, this war broke out in Europe, and that panic struck, if you remember. And you couldn't get a job. I bet I put an application in every place in Seattle, you know, and around there for work. So I finally came on back home. I bummed up and bummed back, rode the freights and all that kind of thing. But anyway, then when I got back here, this Dr. Allison had been our family doctor, and he gave me a job as bookkeeper. I had, throughout the years, I'd taken a course in a business course, you know, one of these, this school that's still over here in Corpus. And so I went in there as a bookkeeper, and I knew everybody at the time. So whenever, of course, a small place like that, it wasn't too much, I'd go up front and wait on people, you know, and I knew all the rural people, I knew all the city people, and everybody knew me. And so doctor decided that he wanted me up front all the time. And he finally made me, he started me studying chemistry, to make a pharmacist out of me, and put me in charge of the place, see? And when this war broke, or before it did, but it was looming, and you remember Pershing coming back out of Mexico, yeah, after chasing Villa? He came here to San Antonio, remember, and at that time we had a little air force of about four planes, if I remember right. But they began asking for men who wanted to take, of course, you know, flying, cadets. And there was a boy out here, Ed Felcher, who was in charge of the King Ranch garage and cars. And another boy here, Oliver Fritz, his brother Leon became a big shot in the offices here for a while, but Leon's dead and gone, and I don't know what had happened to Oliver. He's not here anyway. The three of us went to San Antonio and took the tests. We had a three-day physical, and they passed this A1, and then we were supposed to talk to a commissioned officer, and I don't remember now whether he was lieutenant or captain or what, but as to whether we, in other ways, we were good candidates. And about a month later, I got a letter back from the War Department in Washington to the effect that, and all three of us got the same thing, we didn't have sufficient executive experience. And if I'd have just put down manager of the drugstore when they asked, I put down drug clerk, see? That just showed you how. Of course, I wouldn't be alive today if I'd gotten what I wanted. I'd have been one of the first trainees. You might be killed in training. And in those days when they were, Ed Felcher, the last I heard of him, he went up here to Stinson's school here just outside of San Antonio and took a course in flying. He sent me a card showing him in one of those bird cages they flew in those days. I don't know whatever happened to him after that. But
what was Kingsville like during when you were young?
Just a village, that's what it was.
Just a small, tiny
village. Just a village, yeah.
But how many people were here?
Well, those are the kind of things, see, that is hard for me to, you know, being a boy, say, from 13 on to 17, 18, I didn't pay much attention to things like that. Stuff like that, if you really want something accurate on it, they must, don't they have a, what do they call, log here at their newspaper?
Uh-huh.
And go back to that early stuff and get your stuff there. You'd be much more liable to get it accurate. Well, there's things like that that I couldn't be sure. I would say, though, that when we came into Kingsville, that there wasn't but 300 or 400 people here in the spring of 1907. Not too much more than that.
How big was the main section in town?
In just one block. One block on this side of the track and over there where the record building is now. Just a few places along there. Excuse me.
So then you actually saw Kingsville develop.
I've seen it grow from a little old village to what it is now. I saw the valley grow from a mesquite wilderness to what it is now. When we finally got into it, two of my brothers, younger than I, joined up in the Navy. And I, when I was playing football, while I was working in the drugstore, I was coaching football boys at the second team, and one of the professors was the main coach, and he was from Canada, and when the war broke, he went back north to Canada, see, and he finally got into the Canadian Flying Corps, Canadian Royal AF, and he wrote back and told us boys that had been in his outfits and working with him that if any of us wanted to come up there as cadets, he would vouch for us and get us in, see, to learn to fly. So I would probably have joined up in something here before I went up there when my brothers did, but being the oldest in the family, everybody said, oh, you ought to stay here and take care of the family. You shouldn't all go off, see. But finally, at that time, I taught Sunday school out here in the Christian church, and Dr. Allison was really the main patron of that church. He built the first church downtown that they used to have for them, and I expect he and his family had a lot to do with this church out here. And Dr. Allison was another one who had given me my job there, and he told me I had no business going, but I had a lot of influence with the young boys and around my own age in those days, and a lot of them had joined up right away when war broke through listening to me and that kind of thing. It's my two brothers and that. So we had a pastor out here by the name of Ferguson, and the McLeod family here was very strong in the church. Foy Marshes, for instance, is married to Margaret McLeod, and she was teaching Sunday school in the class right ahead of me. But like I suppose a preacher should be, Ferguson was very much against the war, and he preached a sermon that day that I've got in mind the last time I was there, against the war, and then named me as being to blame for a lot of the boys going up, see. So I can't, and implied that I was getting others to go and I wasn't going myself, see. So I came back and I told my mother what had happened, and I told her, I said, now, I can't stay here now, I'll have to go. So I wrote this professor in Canada, and told him that I was coming up there, and for him to have instructions in the general delivery, Toronto Post Office for me. And I took and sold a couple of ponies I had to get the money to go up there, and headed up there. And I was there about 2 weeks before I joined up, waiting for word from this guy, see, and no word. In the meantime, I'd gone into the armory's buildings and taking the physical. Of course, I took that down here at Fort Sam Houston, and then again, we had the two companies of the 26th Infantry here at that time, you know, on account of the bandit trouble down there. And while I was working for Allison, I had started a kind of a lending library with a lot of books I had and some that Allison, the doctor, had, and that kind of thing. And those kind of people who liked to read and that kind of were kind of patrons of mine. And this doctor that was attached to these two companies, he was one of them. And he said to me, he said, "Bayless," he said, "come on out to camp and let me give you a physical. Make sure that, you know," and I knew it, that I was all right, but I thought, since he was nice enough, I let him do it. So he gave me an okay. "Oh, yeah, there's nothing wrong with him." So I took the Armory's test and got all ready so that when I did join up, that part of it would be over, you know. And no word day after day, and my money was running out, and I couldn't ride home for money. I knew my mother couldn't afford to send me money, and I just had to do something. In the meantime, I'd gone down to the recruiting office that they had downtown for the Air Force. It wasn't in the Armory building like combat and other outfits were. And they wanted letters of recommendation. They wanted dope to show how much education you'd had. I didn't have anything, see, because I depended on this. Next day after I joined up, I get a letter from him. He had been transferred from the flying field that he had given me as an address to another one, and the mail followed him around, and he, "Whatever you do, latest, don't do anything until you see me." And it was too late. I joined up the day before. So that was it. I went overseas with the Canadians in the First World War. And came back here. Was here about a month. Married the girl that I'm married to now. And then went to Seattle. Because while I was gone, my mother had got me to promise that I would go to Seattle, because her mother was still alive up there, and all her sisters and brothers and that kind of thing. And when I got back here, on the strength of letters that I had written back and forth, the two boys that were publishing the paper here at that time offered me a job as a reporter. And I told my mother, I said, "I'd like to take that." And she said, "Oh, you ought to think of someone beside yourself." She said, if you go with me to Seattle, all the boys will go, but if you stay here, they'll want to stay here." Because I was the oldest. So I left in Seattle. So I worked for the Northern Pacific up there 1 year, and then I went to work for the city of Seattle, and we were there 6 years. Wonderful. I was there a year ago this fall in Seattle on a visit, and about 2 or 3 years before that. I love the place in summertime, but in the winter it's drizzle, 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 and cloudy. You go for weeks without any sun, and I just couldn't take it. So my wife was down here visiting. Her sister had been up there, and she came back with her, and we had twin daughters, about 27 months old, and she was at Rio Hondo, and I come by to pick her up. I sold our furniture and everything, and drove down, and she was madder than a wet hen about it, see. It was kind of a dirty trick, I guess, but I was the one that had to be out in the weather, not she. "No," she says, "I'm not going to Florida. If you won't go back to Seattle, well, then how about going to staying here?" So that's, her dad took me into town, and what you'd call a superintendent, I guess, the little old road at that time was a boy that had gone to school with me here, but in the grade just below me, see. But he had been able to go on to college. He had taken a degree in engineering. And when that 22 shop strike occurred, the company sends him down here to work with old man Windsor, who was head of the railroad, president of it. You ever hear of him? You're from Brownsville, you say? Mm-hmm. Windsor? He was the head of the Peavine at that time, is what we call Peavine, or San Bernardino and Rio Grande Valley. You go down there now and you don't see a sign of that railroad in places where it used to be all over there, you know. Of course, there's still some of it. For instance, you have the park that runs out to Rio Hondo still, and then down Point Isabel. But on the other side of town, it's all taken up as far as Hidalgo, you know.
Yeah.
Yet you used to have a lot all the way through there, you know, to Mission and on out past Mission ways. This young fellow, I was trying to think of his name. Now I know it just as well as I do my own, but like I say. Anyway, he was glad to see me. He remembered me very well, and sure, he put me to work